The Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine has been approved for use in children 12 to 15 years old. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm Wilkin Brutus. Tom Hudson is off this week. More kids are now eligible to be vaccinated against the coronavirus. Where can you get your child vaccinated? We want to hear from parents and teenagers. Will you get the shots? A pediatric infectious disease doctor will be with us to answer your questions. Call us now, 800-743-9576, 800-743-9576, and a South Florida City Commission caused public outcry after a local newspaper shed light on its spending habits. Plus, we'll meet Miami-Dade County's very first chief heat officer before talking about the Miami Heat's playoff run. Your questions and phone calls coming up on the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN, made possible by Willie the B-Man, Bee Removal Specialist. I'm Wilkin Brutus. Tom Hudson is off this week, and welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. The CDC has signed off on the expanded use of the Pfizer vaccine for 12 to 15-year-olds. According to state data, there have been nearly 200,000 reported COVID-19 cases in children 0 months to 14 years of age. The age expansion for the Pfizer vaccine comes as demand in the state for vaccine is dropping. Many vaccine providers are ramping down their efforts. And school districts throughout the state are planning to return to 100% in-person learning as soon as this summer. Are you planning to get your child vaccinated? Have you already gotten your child vaccinated? Are you deciding to hold off on the vaccine for your child for now? Share your thoughts with us by calling us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. You can also hit us up at Twitter. We're at WLRN. To help us unpack the latest phase in the vaccine rollout, we are joined now by Dr. Brandon Chitani from UHealth Jackson Health System. He's a pediatric infectious disease specialist. We're also joined by WLRN's health reporter, Veronica Zaragovia. Thank you both. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Hey, thanks for joining us. Dr. Chitani, the FDA has determined that the benefits of this vaccine in individuals 12 years of age and older outweigh potential risks. What are some of the most common side effects, generally, as not everyone experiences side effects, parents should expect when their child is vaccinated?
There are three side effects that have been identified even for this age group, and that includes arm pain, so pain in whichever arm that the vaccine is put into, some headache and some fatigue. Those typically last 1 to 2 days and then resolve.
And are there any other side effects that parents should be aware of?
There are no major other side effects really that parents should be looking out for after this vaccine. Fever is possible, as with any other vaccine, but they just haven't seen the numbers there, the same that they've seen with those other side effects.
Can you tell us the difference between how the different available vaccines work and why the Pfizer vaccine is the only one that has been approved for use in adolescents?
Understood. So the different vaccines that are currently on the market, we have those that use the mRNA, so the pieces of COVID that we're going to influence and tell our body to unwrap it and learn everything about it, basically, so that it's able to identify and attack the virus if we ever were to get exposed to it. The way that is packaged is different depending on the vaccine that we're talking about. Pfizer and Moderna, for example, it's packaged in a little fatty capsule, basically. You take it, that fatty capsule merges with your cells and allows you to recognize the infection and start learning and developing antibodies against the virus. When you have the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, that uses adenovirus, an attenuated virus that's not COVID. But that virus then is used as just its shell to insert the mRNA, that same DNA packaging from COVID, into cells so that then it's recognized as not host and an immune response can be elicited.
And just to clarify, messenger RNA has been around for a while now, right?
Oh, I learned about messenger and RNA back when I was in high school. Hopefully most of our high schools still learn about it, messenger RNA. So that part is not new technology. What is new is that putting it into vaccines. And what it's showing is that this science is radical. we haven't seen this kind of response to vaccines since the age-old MMR, since the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, which is a different science completely.
Now, were the vaccine trials for children different from the adult ones? Is the process the same when testing in children?
The process is more or less the same. There are differences in numbers that you'll see. For example, the Pfizer trial recruited just over 1,000 children from 12 to 16 because you already have a lot of the safety numbers that are there. And the younger and younger that we get, it's more going to be about the safety to make sure that it's safe. The efficacy portion is going to take longer, to be able to include enough children to actually say it's 100% or whatever efficacious. But we have initial study results that do show that there's good efficacy as well.
And speaking of efficacy, is the dose different for children than it is for adults? Is the dosage identical to what has been given to adults?
It's the same. It's the same amount of vaccine that's given, the same schedule currently. I know there is talk about whether or not there's going to be this need for a booster dose 6 months after the second dose, but I haven't read anything that completely confirms that yet. Studies are being determined and follow-up is going to be necessary. But right now, it's the two doses separated by 3 weeks.
That's a lot of clarification for parents who are interested in this. Veronica, how are you?
Doing well, thank you. Great to talk to you.
Awesome to have you. Now, you've been on the ground covering communities throughout the pandemic and the vaccine rollout. Yesterday, you spoke to a 12-year-old, Lauren Kirby Navarro of Miami, about the vaccine.
It's so nice because, like, sometimes when you go out, you don't know who has the COVID and you like to know who would have it. So you just want to be vaccinated so you'll be fine and feel good about it.
And Veronica, you also spoke to her father, Lawrence Kirby, as well.
When I got my vaccination, I felt no side effects whatsoever. I wanted to make sure that she could get the same one that I got, which was Pfizer. So if it had not been Pfizer, I would have hesitated. But being that it is Pfizer, 100% all in.
Of course, a lot of scientists are saying we're now entering a new milestone. Have you encountered many parents and guardians expressing a desire to vaccinate their child?
Yes, I have, both in person, and one of the really nice things about this job is being able to also connect with people through social media. So I have parents who reach out as well on Twitter asking, you know, if I know where vaccines are available or when the next group is going to become eligible. And at this site at Miami Jackson Senior High School, where I spoke to both of them, there were parents telling me that they were equally happy that they came out to get their children vaccinated.
Of course, a lot of parents are happy. A lot of parents are on the fence. What's being done in South Florida to make it as easy as possible for parents or guardians to vaccinate their children?
Right. I mean, for the ones on the fence, this is such a great opportunity that they could hear from Dr. Chetani. But to make it easier, they've opened these temporary sites at schools, some high schools, and that'll be taking place on Thursdays and Saturdays so that on that weekend day, other family members can also come out. And then the University of Miami has a mobile pediatric unit going to underserved areas in the county so that parents don't have to go far. They're stopping at churches and other convenient locations. And pediatricians have told me they've been urging their patients or the parents of their patients to make those appointments even before the CDC had given the green light, just so they were, you know, ready to go. And another thing is offering the Pfizer vaccines at these sites that have been opened up at workplaces. So let's say at Port Miami, for people who work there, they can bring their 12 to 15 year olds for a Pfizer shot too.
And for everyone out there listening, we want to hear from you, South Florida. What are your thoughts on COVID vaccines for kids? Give us a call at 800-743-9576 and tweet us at WLRN. Veronica, do you anticipate the age of the Pfizer vaccine to be lowered anytime soon?
It will. Data from Pfizer's vaccine trials in children age 2 and older should be available this fall. So that might become the next group who could get vaccinated before next year. And then the company also has trials underway on the vaccine for babies age 6 months and older. But that data is not expected to be available until the end of this year or beginning of next year, 2022, so might be a little bit longer.
So right now, Pfizer is clearly in the spotlight right now. Are any other COVID vaccines like Moderna and Johnson & Johnson pursuing expansion for their shots for children? If so, where do those efforts stand right now?
Yeah, what I know is that Moderna has been doing the clinical trials for 12 to 17-year-olds, and they've been finding that it is extremely effective in this group. But I don't know, it's not been said when the company will submit an application to get an emergency use authorization from the FDA so that this group could get vaccinated. And so we'll know, once they submit that data, then there's that review process. And Johnson & Johnson had expanded its trial to include 12 to 17-year-olds, but it's unclear when the results from this study will become available.
And for folks who are joining us right now, I'm Wilkin Brutus. Tom Hudson is off this week. You're listening to South Florida Roundup on WLRN. We are discussing the federal government's approval of or for expanding the age of the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine to 12 and 15-year-olds. We're talking with pediatric infectious disease specialist Dr. Brandon Chitani from UHealth Jackson Health System, and with WLRN's health reporter Veronica Zaragovia. You too can join the conversation by calling us at 800-743-WLRN. You can also tweet us at WLRN. Will you seek shots for your adolescent children, or are you choosing to hold off? Share your thoughts with us. Again, that number is 800-743-9576. Veronica, Florida's vaccination rate isn't great. You've been out reporting this week about the reasons. What have you been hearing from South Florida communities about outreach and challenges?
Well, thank you so much. It's been really fascinating to really understand what are the reasons that people have troubles getting to sites. I mean, I've spoken the other day, Miami Beach had a vaccination site on the sand, at the beach. And I had spoken to a father of two sons. He's a single dad who works in construction. And he said he had brought his sons out to the beach and stumbled upon that site. And that's the kind of thing where, he didn't have the time to start looking for a vaccination site. So it's the kind of, now all the efforts are really shifting in that direction, pop-up sites, how close to people's workplaces or homes can the vaccines be? So that's where things are heading in our region.
A lot of questions to be answered here. We do have a caller. Let's hear from Sandy in Miami. How are you, Sandy?
Oh, well, thank you for taking my call.
Awesome. Well, what's your question?
I have a good question. For example, my wife and myself were vaccinated. We have a 2-year-old, and pretty much for the most part, the entire family is vaccinated. But since it has been coming up, and they just reported today that New York players, baseball players, tested positive after having the vaccine, do we know anything about the potential long-term effects, even if you're asymptomatic, of being positive, even after the vaccine?
Dr. Chitani, your thoughts?
So there hasn't been much data released about long-term because, yes, although we're at a year plus out from when this all started, but understanding immunologically that if you've been vaccinated, even if you come in contact with COVID and become ill from it, the illness won't be as severe, right? And that's because you have some onboard protection against it. Long-term, again, we're going to have to see the follow-up studies to see exactly what people find. We're all learning rapidly, and I'm sure it's a dizzying array of information that's coming out every day.
We have another question. Barbara, we have a question for your child.
How are you?
Hey.
Good. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us.
One of my sons had Kawasaki syndrome, and at that time it was an unknown disease. It had happened that my children's physician, pediatrician rather, had just come from a two-week symposium, and that was one of the diseases that had been discussed. He met me in the office. He opened his office on a Saturday morning. He said, "You have never once brought the child without indication." Straight over to Miami Children's Hospital we went. My son is healthy now. Meanwhile, we had a close friend that had similar symptoms to my son, and to this day, she lives with a severe heart defect. She's underweight, undersized, and the whole gambit, let me tell you. So So I would completely 100%, unless there are other mitigating factors for your children, please get them vaccinated. Anything less than that would be a travesty, because as a parent knows, they always blame themselves. Why didn't I do this, and why did I do that, and so on, et cetera, because our children are a reflection of our morals, our life, and our life choices, and our existence on this planet.
And Barbara, I hate to interrupt. Did you have a specific question for Dr. Chetani?
Yes. How close in are Kawasaki syndromes to the things that these children currently are suffering? And I know that the age difference somehow predicates the illness in children, but and the sudden onset in children, how does it differentiate? Thank you.
Sorry, I think there was some part of that that I couldn't catch everything. What was the, if you could repeat the question?
The sudden symptoms onset for a child. One day having a little cold, and then the next day they have full-blown COVID, they're in the hospital, or they have pneumonia, or they're dead.
So your question is, your child has Kawasaki disease. You're asking what the effects are if that child gets COVID?
Yes, the similarity in symptomology and the sudden onset of COVID in most people, pediatrics.
Well, I guess I can speak to this, that COVID can cause very severe illness in children. It has been shown a lot that, yes, for the large majority, when you look at the large statistics, the illness isn't as severe as it has been seen in adults. But I don't want to discount it, and I thank you for bringing your commentary, that really we don't want our children. Our children are very, to get ill with this, our children are very vulnerable. And so we want to make sure that those that we can protect, we do everything that we can. Two different diagnoses that you can have associated with COVID in children, which is different than adults. One is the acute COVID, which comes on very rapidly, high-grade fevers, cough, respiratory failure. And then the other one is called MISC, which is the multi-inflammatory syndrome in children that looks a lot like Kawasaki's disease. And if you're unaware of Kawasaki's disease, it's this multi-inflammatory, where just everything in your body is inflamed and angry and sore. And if you think that your heart and kidneys and brain can take that kind of inflammation, well, it hurts. And so we don't want our children to go through that. And I completely agree. We need to get them vaccinated. We need to have them protected.
Dr. Chetani, let's get back to the age group dynamic here. UHealth Jackson Health System has been providing the Pfizer vaccine to teens 16 and up for weeks now. What has demand been like for the vaccine in teens so far?
It's picking up. What I'm hearing from front lines is that it at first it was a little slow as more and more people get information. But I hear that future dates are booked up. If you're interested in getting your kid vaccinated here, please call. Please set up those appointments so that we can have them scheduled.
And last question, could we see COVID vaccines for people of all ages in the near future?
It looks like it. It's been a remarkable journey seeing how the age limit has been able to be lowered so rapidly. All to the same, saying that it has been done in a very safe way. We see the CDC guidance that's there. We see other nations with their own separate divisions of health that have given the same kind of guidance to their countries and their peoples. So we know that we're not alone in this and in what we're doing. So I think one day we will get to a lower age. What that age will be, I can't say with 100% certainty, but it's going to happen for sure.
Dr. Brandon Chetani, pediatric infectious disease specialist from UHealth Jackson Health System. Veronica Zaragovia is WLRN's health reporter. Thank you both for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thanks to you.
Still to come, we'll hear from the newspaper editor working on an investigation into the City of Tamarack's commissioner's spending on perks and benefits. You can join the conversation by calling 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Wilkin Brutus. Tom Hudson is off this week. An investigation by the South Florida Sun-Sentinel revealed Tamarack City Commissioners had been granting themselves a lucrative amount of benefits and were about to consider even more. In response, the City Commission proposed hiring a private investigator to determine who leaked the documents to the media. That led to even more public backlash, as some community members said hiring a third party to investigate, quote, who leaked documents that are public record was a waste of taxpayer dollars. Commissioner Mike Gellin represents the city's second district. He had this to say at a meeting this week.
The goal was not to, quote unquote, find the whistleblower or find this person who gave information. We want information to be public. This is a public entity. Everything is public. The question is, and we've still yet to hear the answer from the city manager, is who gave the approval to put these items on the agenda?
If you live in Tamarack or have been following this story as it unfolds, what are your thoughts? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576, or tweet us. We're at WLRN. Joining us now is Juan Ortega. He is the assistant news director for South Florida Sun-Sentinel, and he has been working with the reporter who broke the story. Juan, how are you?
Doing well. How are you today, Wilkin?
Hey, all is well. Thanks for joining us. Now, according to the South Florida Sun-Sentinel, city officials in Tamarack labeled the memo on excessive spending that was made public as a, quote, leak. Juan, how did this story come about?
Well, Lisa Hurrius, the reporter on that story, is well-sourced, and she her reporting led her to begin looking into all these decisions that were being made to basically boost the perks that the elected officials were receiving. And it had evolved from there because really this had been a string of decisions in which they were increasing their personal initiatives. Like one initial story had shed light on the fact that they had since September upped their fund for personal initiatives up to $25,000 each. Earlier this year, they gave themselves a new $15,000 pot of money for local travel. And that had been on top of another pot of $55,000 that they share for out-of-town conferences and conventions. So all this led Hurrius to start shedding light on the fact that they were getting all these perks and benefits. And it's noteworthy too that this ability to be able to receive these benefits stood far and away above other communities. Like some of the more populous cities, like, you know, even Fort Lauderdale, they don't compare to what this smaller city in West Broward had allotted to their elected officials.
Now, you're the editor who worked with the reporter on this story. One thing that you found is that the city manager takes center stage in this report. What was his role in response to the public records request?
Repeat your question. What is it that you're asking?
The city manager. What was his role in this report?
Well, you know, the city manager, he's the CEO of the city and is basically in charge of overseeing all this. And so his role is he serves at the will of the elected officials, in this case, the commissioners. And so what Hurrius uncovered was that he had been asked to meet with one of the commissioners who, in one of the most recent proposals, had suggested upping like health benefits and an additional like stipends for the commissioners. And so he goes, and after this discussion, the city staff is told to start putting together another proposal for these benefits that the commissioners would receive. And we report in the newspaper how this proposal like was already underway even before it goes before like an actual meeting to be approved. And consequently, after the news article ran, that proposal and that consideration to receive even more benefits ends up getting tabled and shelved, which led us up to maybe a few weeks ago, in which, as you mentioned earlier, they decided to try to find out, like, hey, how did this memo surface, and ultimately, just like 2 nights ago, they ended up like having to change apart and decided, after much criticism from the community and the public, to stop this pursuit to try to find out how that memo became public.
And at the taxpayers' expense, they considered spending $50,000 to hire a legal team, right? Is this common for a small city like this?
I've been with the newspaper now more than 15 years. Hurriyesh has been there more than longer. And me personally, I've never seen anything like it. It's a rarity. Like not only the idea of like continuing to up the perks and the benefits, but also the reaction. Like in one of the earlier meetings a few weeks ago, the attention wasn't the commissioners addressing the public about their decision making with increasing these incentives. And I should say, of this 5-person panel, the mayor stood alone in saying like, no, this is outrageous. Whereas the other commissioners weren't publicly addressing like why they supported this. Instead, the focus was on like this idea of like why a public record was released to the public, and therefore they ended up like doing away with that just recently, 2 nights ago.
Of course, by the report, it seems like multiple officials were involved in this. Did a public request also identify perhaps the main commissioner behind the lucrative perks and benefits? If so, what was his or her response?
There's a commissioner, Marlon Bolton, who it's revealed through the public records that the Sun Sentinel requested subsequent to that. And it shows that he indeed had met with the city staff, like asking for this latest round of benefits. And notably, maybe two or so, like several days ago, there had been one of the public meetings in which everyone had been basically asking, like, hey, who put this on the table for consideration? And he didn't step forward to identify himself as a person who had this discussion for the benefits. And so in his response days later, he said that, like, one, it was misrepresented in the sense like he felt that his intentions were wanting to somehow save money. Secondly, he also like said that he stayed mum during the meeting a few weeks ago because he didn't want to throw other commissioners under the bus for wanting to propose more perks and benefits, which the commissioners denied. They said that they were not asking for these perks, as Commissioner Bolton had told us.
I'm Wilkin Brutus, filling in for Tom Hudson. This is South Florida Roundup on WLRN. We are speaking with South Florida Sun Sentinel editor Juan Ortega about an investigation into the City of Tamarack's commission spending on perks and benefits. Share your thoughts with us by calling 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. You can also tweet us at WLRN. Juan, during a commission meeting held on Wednesday, several commissioners said they had no knowledge of the memo that was given to Sun Sentinel. Can you explain to us how city commissions identify agenda items? Is it possible for agenda items to be identified without the commission's consent?
There is, as with any government proceedings, a bureaucracy, and usually the way that it works its way through the process is that, you know, maybe an elected official will go ahead and offer this, and then it wends its way back to a public meeting. To answer your question, I think if an elected official is proactive and wants to know more information about, say, like a memo that is percolating around, then they have every, you know, right and initiative to go ahead and try to get to the bottom of that ahead of time. And so in this instance, like some commissioners expressed surprise in the fact that this proposal to get so many more benefits had been developing, and that the newspaper went ahead and shed light on that before it made it to a public meeting.
So what happens moving forward for folks who are just learning about this controversy?
Well, moving forward, there's still like a lot to unspool. Like one of the latest things that has come up is there's an ethics watchdog in Broward County. It's its own agency, and they review like any questionable activity. And so they've it came to light just on Wednesday that that agency is indeed looking into this latest chapter in Tamarack officials' travel expenses. And so we can expect to see more of that. And then also Hurry-ish is doing some, you know, further digging into what's transpired in recent months pertaining to all the spending in Tamarack.
Wow. There's a lot there. Fascinating report. Juan Ortega is an editor at the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Thank you so much for your time, Juan.
Oh, thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Likewise. Take care. Yep. Still to come, Miami-Dade County has appointed its first ever chief heat officer to help the county prepare for increasing temperatures. Plus, the Miami Heat is headed to the playoffs. 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. I'm Wilkin Brutus. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm filling in this week for Tom Hudson. Have you noticed that those hot, sticky days in South Florida seem to be happening more often? Well, it's not in your head. Historically, Florida would experience a heat index over 100 degrees Fahrenheit about 25 days a year. A 2019 study by the Union of Concerned Scientists predicts that by 2050, Florida would have 105 days with a heat index over 100 degrees. In order to prepare for those hot, sticky days, Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine Cava announced the county's first ever Chief Heat Officer, Jane Gilbert. The Chief Heat Officer will develop plans to mitigate the social, environmental, and economic impact that extreme heat has on our daily lives in the county and surrounding areas. I spoke with Jane Gilbert yesterday.
Climate change in Florida is making extreme heat worse for everyone. The elderly, outdoor workers, pregnant women, children, and low-income communities are disproportionately affected by it. What are some of the growing risks vulnerable communities are facing from extreme heat?
How people live, how they work, and how they move around. So starting with how they live, low-income communities can pay up to 20% of their overall household expenses can go to utilities. As you know, as a Florida resident, as the heat goes up, so does your FPL bill. It becomes a cost burden first, an economic burden, to be able to keep your home at a comfortable level. And if you're not able to afford that, then you're compromising your health. And that can be particularly true for single moms who might be pregnant or elderly on fixed income who might be in substandard housing where, because of the leaky building envelope plus the old AC units, it's really expensive and it's hard to keep it cool. The next is work. We have a number of outdoor workers in construction, in landscaping, in agricultural work, in police and fire out there, our kids and parks and recreation staff. There's a large number of people who work outside every day. And as you get more days over with a heat index of over 100, you're putting those people at risk of heat stress and even heat stroke. So we need to look at labor standards.
Right. And as the weather increases, the heat, including that humidity, all
correct. The so it's not just the temperature, it's the combination of temperature plus humidity that gets our heat index. So we may be at a temperature of only 85 degrees, but because we have 80 or 90% humidity, that could be well over 90 and close to 100.
Part of this initiative is to address a term called urban heat island effect. It's a term I've learned recently. What is an urban heat island and what are some of the countywide solutions to that?
Standing under a well-shaded tree canopy can be 30 degrees Fahrenheit or more cooler than standing in the middle of a parking lot or an open, unforested area. In Miami-Dade County, our average tree canopy is under 20%. And in our low-income communities, disproportionately, that that percentage of tree canopy is much lower. It can be down to 10 or even 5%. And this impacts kids playing outside. It impacts someone trying to walk to a bus stop, stay at a bus stop. Even a man-made, like, built bus shelter is far warmer than if that bus shelter also had a tree over it. And so we need an aggressive campaign to build back our tree canopy. Luckily, the county has had its Million Trees Miami program and Adopt a Tree, and they've planted hundreds of thousands of trees with that. But we're going to accelerate that work. And through the county's recently drafted climate action strategy, we set a goal of achieving 30% tree canopy by 2030. Through these different programs, through our partnerships with the cities, who are also updating their urban forestry plans and their street tree master plans. And all of those tree planting efforts need to prioritize those areas where our tree canopy is the lightest, those being in our urban heat islands. So tree canopy is a big piece for urban heat island. Another is what kind of pavement and surfaces we use. So a blacktop absorbs heat and just creates a much hotter environment. If you have a lighter shade or even white, it's much more cooling. It reflects that heat. So in the city of Miami, they've wild back looked at urban heat island and passed an ordinance requiring cool roofs and cool pavements. And we're going to be looking at that at the county. The Miami Beach is testing some cool pavements right now. These are some of the other ways that we can address that urban heat island effect.
Jane, you also develop strategies as the chief resilience officer for the city of Miami. Yes. What is the Resilient 305 Network, and how has your previous role as chief resilience officer helped you prepare for this new role?
Resilient 305 is a partnership between Miami-Dade County, City of Miami, Miami Beach, and now we have really all the municipalities within Miami-Dade County have joined the effort, and many other anchor institutions, nonprofit organizations are also leading actions. We worked together over a two-year period to create a overarching strategy, the Resilient 305 strategy. Anyone can view it at resilient305.com. And the Miami Foundation is another partner in that work. It's an overarching strategy to deal with some of the increasing shocks and stresses our city and many cities all over the world are facing with climate change, increasing density with urbanization, and with globalization. We had Zika a few years back. That's because we have so many people traveling back and forth. And you know, we're more vulnerable to COVID because of all our travelers back and forth here. So that's part of globalization. The heat work that I'm going to be doing is going to be framed under that Resilient 305 strategy, which has three main categories. It has all sorts of actions and goals related to the lives and livelihoods of people. So that's where we're going to be dealing with the employment, the communication, the education, and some direct emergency response initiatives. And then there's places, and that's where we're going to be dealing with that urban heat island and land use planning and tree planting and green infrastructure. And then pathways is around the resource sharing between all our jurisdictions and universities with data collection, et cetera, the sort of the tools and resources we need to implement this work.
South Floridians experience a few weeks of extreme heat days where it feels like 105 degrees and above. But by mid-century, South Floridians could experience up to 4 months of extreme hot days, according to a 2019 study by the Union of Concerned Scientists. Now, you're also leading a heat health task force alongside Dr. Cheryl Holder. She's a well-regarded clinician and community activist. Tell me about this heat health task force.
She's realized this heat vulnerability, that it is the silent killer. It's the number one cause of fatalities for climate-related disasters. My position actually formally doesn't start till next month, but as soon as it does, we're hitting the ground running to put together a task force of advisors from our university sector, from our for-profit, you know, large employers, small employers, from the nonprofit groups. We've had a number of organizations on the ground, Catalyst Miami and others we count who've been working on engaging low-income communities about their concerns on heat and really starting to draft policy agendas that we're going to take a very strong look at and see what we can do to try to move some of that forward. So we're going to have this multi-stakeholder expert group work with together over about a 6 to 10 month period. And in that, we'll also do other outreach to create a comprehensive plan under that Resilient 305 platform or framework, and it will be implemented through that framework. And then the county is working on creating a permanent position. I was really hired to help launch this and get it going.
Again, Jane, all pun intended, the chief heat officer position is a very cool one. And May 28th is National Heat Awareness Day. It's certainly a good time to heat up the conversation. So I just want to say thank you so much for your time and for your service.
Thank you, Wilkin.
I'm Wilkin Brutus, in for Tom Hudson. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. We just heard a conversation I had yesterday with Miami-Dade County's first ever Chief Heat Officer, Jane Gilbert. Finally on the Roundup, the Miami Heat have clinched a spot in the NBA playoffs for the second year in a row. Sports reporter Anthony Chang from the Miami Herald joins us now to talk about what we can expect from the team this postseason. We'd also like to hear from you. Are you a Heat fan? Feeling pumped up about this postseason? Share your thoughts with us by calling 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. You can also tweet us at WLRN. Anthony, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me. How are you?
Man, thanks for joining us. It's pretty exciting. We're in the postseason. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, it's been a very unique and interesting season, just obviously with all the COVID protocols and the Heat having a very quick turnaround and short offseason after making the finals last October and just starting back up in December. It was like a month and a half break in between seasons. So it's felt like one run-on season, but here they are. The Heat are back in the playoffs. They seem to be playing their best basketball.
Yeah, you know,
at the right time.
At the right time.
Yeah, so you know, right now things are looking good for them.
Now, did you also report from the bubble last year? How was your reported your coverage last year?
I did not. So, you know, when during that run, I was covering the games from home. Access was very limited, and they didn't allow too many media members to be inside the bubble. It was mostly national media. So, unfortunately, during that magical run to the finals, unexpected run to the finals, I was covering games from home and interviewing players and coaches over Zoom, like most around the country.
Of course, fans would like to hear me say the defending champions, but the defending Eastern Conference champions, Miami Heat, have been able to find success so far despite several injuries. What are some short and long-term takeaways from the Heat's playoff clinching win over the Celtics and the huge victory over the Philadelphia 76ers last night?
That they're still one of the best teams in the Eastern Conference. I think, you know, because of their early season struggles, maybe some forgot that. But when they're healthy, and this is probably the healthiest they've been all season, when Jimmy Butler's healthy and available, and Bam Adebayo's healthy, Tyler Hero, Goran Dragic, like all the key players are available right now, and they're all playing very well. The best they've had all season. And you know, I think this past really month, they've really turned a corner. You know, because of all the inconsistency early on with the guys in and out of the lineup and different circumstances, the quick turnaround. There were a lot of ups and downs, but the past month and a half, you've seen the offense really improve. They have a top 10 offense, you know, over the past 6 weeks. The defense has been pretty steady all season, and it's resulted in really a lot of wins the past month or so. I mean, there was a point a few weeks ago where we didn't even know if they were going to make the playoffs, and you know, here they are with a couple games left, and they have a chance to move all the way up to four in the standings and maybe open the playoffs at home.
You talk about some of those inconsistencies that sort of deter the offense to some extent. Tyler Hero seems like he's back into his old form. Right. What do you think brought his mojo back?
You know, he's been dealing with lingering injuries all year, whether it was the neck injury, more recently the foot injury that kept him out six games, but he had been playing through the pain even before he went out during that stretch. So, I think we're seeing a healthy Tyler Hero, and again, like most of the guys on this team, it has been an inconsistent year for him. There have been ups and downs, but he is only 21. I think people forget that, and we expected a lot after what he did in the bubble, but here he is. With the playoffs approaching, he's healthy, and he looks like the guy that that Miami fell in love with during last season's playoff run, making a lot of shots, making a lot of big shots. And just really an exciting player to watch.
Man, thanks for reminding fans that Tyler is still 21 years old.
Yeah, it's crazy, right? Yeah, I know.
I had to remind myself about that. Now let's talk about wisdom here. UD, Udonis Haslem, got to play last night. Miami Heat's all-time leading rebounder made his first appearance of the season. Why was that significant?
That was an amazing moment. To me, that was probably the highlight of the season. Just because I think we all expected Udonis to play at some point, because it wouldn't have officially counted as his 18th NBA season unless he got into a game. There were only, counting last night, there were only three games left. So it had to happen over the next few days. And last night was a final regular season home game. So he finally got a chance to get in, and he only played 3 minutes, but they were legendary legendary 3 minutes. He got in there, took a charge, made his trademark baseline jumper, got ejected after getting into a heated exchange with Dwight Howard. So as Udonis said, if that was his final game, he went out in true Udonis fashion by getting ejected. So it was a really fun night last night, not only because he played well, but also just everything surrounding Udonis' season debut. The fans, you could tell, really loved every second of it.
And just for reference, the Miami Heat dominated that game. So this is a two-pronged question. One, why did UD get ejected? And two, how was Miami Heat able to dominate the 76ers?
Well, Udonis got ejected because he did not like the way 76ers center Dwight Howard threw him down as they fought for a rebound. So Udonis let him know that, he said. And I guess Dwight Howard disagreed with what Udonis was telling him, and they kind of went back and forth, and Udonis put a finger in Dwight's face, and then it just kind of got a little out of control, and Udonis was ejected seconds later. But the Heat were able to really control that game from start to finish against Philadelphia, which, by the way, has the best record in the Eastern Conference and has been one of the best teams in the NBA all season, just by their offense. Again, after starting the season slow and being among the league's worst for the first 3 months of the season, they've been one of the best in the NBA over the past month. And it was, again, really, really good against Philadelphia. They shot over 50% for the seventh time in eight games. Defensively, they really defended Joel Embiid, Philadelphia's MVP candidate, really well. I think he was held to like 6 points and two rebounds, which is, very below his standard. So they really just dominated on both ends of the court. And it was a really impressive performance because of the level of competition it came against. Philadelphia is a team that really, is expected to compete for a championship this season.
Of course, it's too early in the postseason to predict what are some of the challenges and strengths that the Miami Heat may face in the playoffs. But do you have any early predictions as to what those challenges and strengths may be?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think any team in the East wants to face the Heat in the first round. I'll say that. It doesn't matter if Brooklyn, with KD and Kyrie Irving and all the talent on that team, I don't think any team wants to face this Heat squad, just because, this is a team that won the East last season. They have a lot of the core back. They're playing really well. They look as close to the team from the bubble as they have all season. Who knows what's going to happen with you. I think a lot of it depends on matchups. There's still a lot to be worked out over these final few days. We don't know who they're going to play in the first round. But if this team gets into the 4-5 matchup and they face like Atlanta in the first round, I would predict the Heat to win that series. And then from there, maybe they'll get on a magical run again. They look like the team right now that surprised everybody last season.
I asked you earlier about your coverage and whether you actually covered the Heat in the bubble last year. This year is a new time period. It's a new dynamic. Are folks watching the games in the American Airlines Arena? If so, have you seen it? What's the atmosphere like?
Yeah, so I haven't traveled this season. Usually I go to all the road games. This year I've covered the road games from home, but I have gone to all of the home games. And the season started with no fans in the building. It was very different and kind of eerie to be in that building with zero fans. You know, piped in crowd noise, artificial, just artificial fans, fan noise, just to keep, kind of give a simulate the feel of a real game. But right now, you know, the building for the past few weeks, it's actually felt like a legit atmosphere. There's, I think, about 5,600 fans right now allowed in, which is about 29-30% of capacity. Still not a lot, but based on where, you know, things started this season, it feels like a lot. And I think, you know, for the playoffs, they haven't really set a capacity number yet, but the expectation is that number will rise again. I don't know to how much. I mean, maybe up to like 8,000 or 9,000 to be around 50%. But as of right now, for the past few weeks, it's felt as close to a normal atmosphere than it has in a year, 2 years since, you know, the pandemic began.
The pandemic has certainly challenged all of us psychologically. Have players talked about the way in which an empty stadium may affect their play? It's certainly something fans perhaps don't consider, but with players who are used to 20,000 folks in a stadium to now being dwindled to, you know, 5,000, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, early on when there was, you know, most of the arenas weren't allowing any fans, that was a question we would ask them, and they said, yeah, it is different. I mean, even just shooting a basketball, like the sight lines of in the background of shooting a basketball, like it's different when you have no fans in the building and there's no fans around you. So it did take some getting used to. I think playing in the bubble helped a little bit, just because, you know, there weren't any fans in the bubble either, but they were smaller buildings, so it was a little bit of a different feel than, you know, playing in
Anthony,
arena.
I have to cut you off. So sorry, we're running out of time. Anthony Chang is the Miami Heat reporter for the Miami Herald. Again, thank you so much for your time, Anthony.
No problem. Thank you.
All right. That will do for the South Florida Roundup.